brother of the more famous Jack, written by Barbara Trapido and read by Jan Francis.
Chapter 1. Since I have no other, I use as preface Jacob's preface, which I read sneakily 15 years ago when it lay on the Goldman's breakfast table amid the cornflakes. I cannot in good conscience give the statutory thanks to my wife, it says, for helpful comments on the manuscript, patient reading of drafts or corrections to proofs, because Jane did none of these things. She seldom reads, and when she does, it is never a thing of mine. Going by the lavish thanks to wives which I find in the prefaces to other men's books, I deem myself uniquely injudicious in having married a woman who refuses to double as a high-grade editorial assistant. Since custom requires me to thank her for something, I thank her instead for the agreeable fact of her continuing presence, which in 20 years I have never presumed to expect. It was a marriage characterised, among other things, by the fact that Jacob was alternately infuriated and enchanted by Jane's resolutely playing the country wife. There is no doubt that it influenced the paths that I chose to tread. I met Jacob Goldman when he interviewed me for a university place in London during my final year in the genteel North London day school to which my mother had sent me. My mother, the widow of a modestly comfortable local greengrocer, had done so at some sacrifice to herself, in the hope that I would acquire the right accent and be fit to mix in the right circles. As parents are destined to be disappointed, I believe she was disappointed that her decision ensured instead that I acquired a collection of creditable A-levels and became one of Jacob's pupils. Jacob, an impressive and powerful left-wing philosopher up from the East End, talked to us with a marvellous and winning fluency about the transcendental dialectic in a huge Cockney voice full of glottal stops, like a plumber's mate. He was the professor of philosophy in that labyrinthine Victorian edifice and quickly became my father figure and cultural hero. I had read Lord David Cecil's references to his rooms at Oxford, but Jacob interviewed me in nothing one could dignify with such a word. He interviewed me in what appeared to be an aerated cupboard.
"I'll be frank with you," he said. "I had you up here because your head's report on you is so unfavourable, it leads me to suspect that you may be somewhat brighter than the head. You may, of course, be no more than an opinionated troublemaker. Which do you think you are?"
He fixed me under his black horsehair eyebrows with what I took to be smouldering animosity. It was, of course, well before the day I saw him ask into his kitchen a collection of rain-soaked Jehovah's Witnesses and offer them cups of tea, for he was the kindest of people. He had hair to match his eyebrows, sprouting, intimidatingly, like sofa stuffing from the neck of his open shirt. I must have shrugged in an unprepossessing manner. How could I put across to him how it was with me? How much I was driven timorously by a desire to please and yet found myself stubbornly unable to do so by obedience to any values but my own. Since my values were not shared by those around me, I couldn't possibly win. The lack of recognition, I think, made me show off in an attempt to force it from those in authority over me. "Sometimes I show off," I said.
"Me too," Jacob said.
I was, in a minor way, a troublemaker at school, always polite, guilty of little more than reading James Joyce under the desk in religious education classes, truanting from all sporting occasions and disregarding the finer points of the school uniform, balking, in short, at those aspects of school which seemed to me peripheral to the educational process. Education, as I had always hoped for it, is what I got from Jacob.